My name is Bob Campbell, and I'm the moderator for today, and I'm also the chair of the board for the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs. We want to, first of all, acknowledge our ongoing partnership with the University of Lethbridge, the Lethbridge Herald, Shaw TV, and Erickson's Restaurant. We value that partnership. And today, we also have another partner involved with our session. This session has been organized jointly with the United Services Institute here in Lethbridge. And we're pleased to have Jim Donaldson and Mike Duguay here from the LUSI, get that acronym right, with us today. And we welcome you very much, and all of the members in the audience as well. We also want to extend a warm welcome to Howard Tennant, who is a longtime friend of SACPAW, and he's also the honorary lieutenant colonel of the 18th Air Defense Regiment here in Lethbridge. And while we're at it, we're pleased to have our mayor here today as well, too, Mayor Bob Tarluck. So welcome to you all. Just a couple of more housekeeping things. Of course, you know there is nothing's free in this world, and $8, please, in the basket. And there will be someone around to pick that up during the meeting. And if someone would be so kind as to count, and that's, you know, multiply by the number of people at the table times 8 and make sure that's what's in the basket. If there's more, that's all right. Also, while I'm at it, and I'll repeat this at the end of the session as well, next week's session we have former Minister of Advanced Education Dave Hancock will be our speaker, and we're quite pleased with this, and he will be addressing what are the burning issues for Alberta. Also on your table, you will find a survey from the Southern Alberta Council on how we did this past year, and we'd really appreciate it if you would take the time to fill those out during the meeting today, because this will assist us greatly in planning our coming year. Missile defense, how does it work and do we really need it? Missile defense is back in the international radar screen. NATO has unveiled a plan for Europe, which reportedly is almost identical to the Pentagon's plan shield for North America. Thus far, Canada has resisted these overtures from the United States to join in the North American shield. But will Canada, under this new government, new conservative government, reverse this position? After all, it's a member of both NATO and NORAD. And so, politics aside, does the bullet-to-bullet technology of a missile defense shield actually work? How much would this questionable system cost the taxpayer? And which countries would we be defending ourselves against? Who would likely be aiming the ballistic missiles at Canada? Our speaker today, Dr. David Berkeson, is well qualified to address this topic. Dr. Berkeson earned his PhD in history in 1971 at the University of Toronto. His academic areas of concentration include modern Canadian politics, Canadian defense and foreign policy, and Canadian military history. He is well known nationally as a commentator on political and defense issues, and I'm sure some of you will recognize him from seeing him frequently on television. You've read his bio. He's highly accomplished and highly qualified to address this issue. And so we would now like to turn the time over to Dr. Berkeson. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that very nice introduction. It ought to have been nice because I wrote it myself. I'm going to talk for a few minutes about missile defense, and I'm going to use PowerPoint. And the reason I use PowerPoint is because they say that PowerPoint is so simple that any idiot can learn how to use it, and it only took me about 3 minutes. They also say that power corrupts, and PowerPoint corrupts absolutely, so I hope I won't be doing that here this afternoon. Missile defense is an issue back in the news, and it is an issue that is going to continue to be in the news for some considerable period of time, I believe, because the issue of missile defense is fundamentally one of how do countries in this day and age protect themselves against the possible threat of long-range weapons that may, probably will, contain weapons of mass destruction? And I think we need to look at, we as Canadians need to look at the question of missile defense from a much longer range perspective and with a little less partisanship than we have looked at it in these past few years. And I hope that my talk in the next few minutes will help you with that. And I will be not ashamed and not afraid to tell you what my views are with regard to the question of Canadian participation in missile defense. Now, this confounded gadget actually works, so I'll be able to show you this slide presentation. And I don't see that it is working. There we go, Mike. You're going to have to flick it yourself. I should hold these cards up. We can do it this way. I'm sorry this is taking a bit of time. We had it all set up. We were working on this for about an hour. Okay, well, there it is. What is missile defense? Well, most of you probably think of missile defense in terms of what we just heard, bullet hitting bullet, which is fundamentally what it is. It's missiles that are going to defend against incoming missiles of different kinds of ranges. And in fact, missile defense today is a reality, and the technology of missile defense has been perfected with regard to certain kinds of missiles. Not all missiles, but certain kinds of missiles. But missile versus missile is not the only aspect of missile defense that is being studied. The United States has put a tremendous amount of money and a tremendous amount of research into a large aerial-borne laser that would be carried by a converted Boeing 747. And this aerial laser, which is designed to try to take out or to interrupt missiles within the first 5 or so minutes after launch, which is called the boost phase of the missile, is about to be tested for the first time in the fall of this year. No one knows how it's going to work, but certainly U.S. defense scientists think that there's a possibility in the long run that the laser may be far more effective against incoming enemy missiles than will other missiles. So it's the development of missiles, lasers, and other weapons which can destroy missiles in flight at some point of the flight. And one of the reasons why there is a growing reliance or a growing attention being paid to missile defense is simply because there has been and there continues to be a proliferation of nations that have access to long-range missile technology or are developing their own long-range missile technology or are adapting older technologies to produce newer long-range missiles. That would include, for example, in the latter case, the Syrians. And it's very interesting that I brought with me a copy of a paper that I was just reading last night. I happen to read it every week. It's called Defense News. It comes out of Washington. It's a weekly paper that is published both for the defense industry and for people involved in defense and military affairs. And right on the front page, Gulf Cooperation Council states fear Iranian nuke regional war. And if you will indulge me for a second, Sami Al-Faraj, president of the Kuwait Center for Strategic Studies, which is a Kuwaiti foreign minister think tank, and he says, and I quote, "A military escalation between Iran and the West would pose the greatest challenge ever to member states of the Gulf Cooperation Council." And this is Bahrain, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Oman, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates. And he goes on, and I quote him, "The Kuwaiti armed forces have deployed Patriot missiles around highly populated areas and strategic sites to defend against Iranian ballistic missiles," unquote. And the Patriot is one of those systems that I was mentioning a few minutes ago that is capable of taking out certain kinds of ballistic missiles, but not long-range ballistic missiles. And the problem is proliferation. And here you see the countries that we know, North Korea, China, Pakistan, Iran, etc., etc., a lot of the technology that they have acquired, some of it they have developed themselves, some of it has been acquired from Russia, some of it has been developed from old Russian or Soviet systems, such as the Scud, which was fundamentally what the Iranians have been building their missile systems on for the last 10 to 15 years, and they're far, far advanced from where the Scud was when they first started to take it. This is a map today that shows you the picture as we know it of who has got ballistic missiles. The countries that are pictured here in red can deploy missiles with ranges in excess of 1,000 kilometers. The countries in green can deploy missiles up to 1,000 kilometers. But remember, the very cogent lesson that we need to remember from the Iraq War was the United States and a number of other countries said, there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Nobody found them. Just as intelligence can be wrong about what is there, intelligence can also be wrong about what is not there. And this is the way we see the picture, but we do not know who else may be working on long-range missiles and weapons of mass destruction at any given moment. But this is the current picture. So missiles are definitely, in a sense, the weapon system of the day. This is what people are working on around the world. This is what people are developing. And ask yourself, why are they developing them? It's a universal question, and it goes to the age-old problem of humankind and war and destruction and so on, and far beyond the range of my talk today. But is that working? Yeah, there we go. The idea of missile defense is not new. The first intercontinental ballistic missile, which was successfully tested by the then Soviet Union in 1957, just about coincided with the beginnings of the development in the United States of what they thought at the time would be an anti-missile missile, which was called the Nike Zeus. And you actually have got a picture of the Nike Zeus. The Nike Zeus was never satisfactorily tested. No one knows whether or not it would have worked. But the intention was at the time, this is almost 50 years ago, the intention was to build and develop anti-missile systems at the time. And in the 60s, more development, Defender. The idea of Project Defender was to try to develop an anti-missile system that would sit in naval vessels offshore and actually hit missiles that were launched from near coastal areas in what is called the boost phase again, that is shortly after takeoff, when all the damage that is done is actually done back to the enemy country that started the missile in the first place, the Sentinel program, the Safeguard program, and so on. Both sides, quote-unquote, the United States and the Soviet Union, worked diligently on the development of anti-nuclear technology throughout the 1960s. Anti-missile technology throughout the 1960s. As far as we know, they were not successful, although a number of batteries of anti-missile missiles were in fact deployed. The Soviet Union deployed two batteries, and the United States also deployed two batteries of a combined Sentinel safeguard system. But in 1972, the two superpowers decided that they would conclude a treaty, and that's the famous ABM treaty, Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which would stop all further development on anti-missile technology. And why did they do that? Very important. Because they came to the conclusion that the development of anti-missile technology was counterproductive in the kind of international environment that existed at the time with the nuclear balance of terror, what we called mutually assured destruction, or MAD, and that the furtherance of anti-missile technology would simply create even more impetus for the development of even more offensive warheads than would be the case without ABM technology. And why would that be? Well, because let us say that the Soviet Union succeeded in developing a number of anti-missile missile sites. The incentive to the United States would be to develop even more effective warheads, to proliferate, to build even more warheads, to build warheads that would themselves break up into 7 or 8 or 12 or half a dozen or 2 dozen different warheads to hit independent targets, that the perfection of an anti-missile system was only an impetus to the other side to build even more missiles. And so, since they were at that time beginning to think at least of developing some kind of a balance of terror, there was no point, they thought, in continuing to develop anti-missile technology. And so the ABM treaty was basically designed to lay them open to attacks from the other side. We have no defense. We've got the two batteries that we set up in the United States. We've got the two batteries we set up in the Soviet Union, but that's it. We are not going to do any more of that, and we will agree not to develop anti-nuclear technologies and anti-missile technologies in the future. And the ABM treaty stopped effectively all work on the process. We then got the beginnings of the Strategic Defense Initiative. That was at the bottom of the last screen, but I'm sure you've all heard of it because it has been known, it was dubbed at the time and has been known ever since as quote-unquote Star Wars. And this was a very, very elaborate system that was being thought up. It was mostly theory. During the administration of President Reagan in the early 1980s, which would employ all kinds of satellite sensor systems and airborne sensors and ground-based sensors and a number of different kinds of weapons to be able to detect a large-scale nuclear missile attack on North America and to defeat the great majority of those missiles. It was a system that never saw realization. It was a system that no one is sure if it ever could have seen realization. It was a system that the United States nonetheless spent billions of dollars on and certainly scared the hell out of the Soviet Union, who believed that it might be possible over 10 or 15 years to actually produce such a system. And the Soviets knew that they could not, they did not have the technology and they did not have the resources to be able to overcome such a system. Political scientists believe that it was the Star Wars system or the threat of Star Wars that was actually the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union, the realization that they simply could not compete in terms of resources and technology with the United States. We'll never know. Star Wars essentially died with the end of the Cold War. But remember what Star Wars was supposed to do. It was supposed to defeat a multi-missile threat from the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union launched 1,000 missiles at the United States, as it was certainly capable of doing at the time. The Star Wars system was supposed to take care of the vast majority, if not all, of those missiles. And that is not the case with the National Missile Defense System that the United States is beginning to deploy today. It is not designed to do anything like that. So we get to the 21st century, National Missile Defense. National Missile Defense is a program that has been worked on in the U.S. for about 5 years now. The U.S. has begun to deploy certain aspects of that system. They started to deploy it last year. The system has been tested and has been found wanting as often as it has been successful. It is a system that is designed as a limited defense system using both satellites and sea-based sensors to detect the takeoff of hostile missiles, and using a relatively small number of interceptors launched from the west coast of the United States, California, and Alaska, to track incoming missiles and to take them out in mid-flight. The system is designed at its maximum capability probably to destroy somewhere in the neighborhood of a dozen to two dozen missiles that might be launched at North America. Important point being that in order to continue to develop and to deploy the system, the United States gave notice to Russia that it would formally withdraw from the ABM treaty, and the withdrawal took place at the end of June 2002, and that was the end of the ABM treaty. Now, this is a bit of a diagram of what is supposed to take place with missile defense, and what you've got is you've got the actual launch of the missile over here. And you notice how it's being launched in a place that suspiciously looks like North Korea, although it could also have been, of course, Iran. Various tracking systems that are satellite-based and sea-based pick up the launch, pick up, in other words, the boost phase, pick up the flare, pick up the heat signature from the missile taking off and begin to track it. Signal goes back to command and control, which is actually going to be based in Colorado Springs. It will be either a part of the NORAD structure or not, depending on what Canada does over the next several years. Canada continues to stay out of missile defense. It will not be part of the NORAD structure. If we join missile defense, it will. And then a number of systems are used to track the missile and to intercept it. Now, let me just say right here that this is a very, very difficult prospect. Is it impossible? That's the question. First thing to note is that this is not designed to counter an intermediate, or what we would have called, once upon a time, an intermediate range ballistic missile. That is a missile of about 1,000 to 1,500 kilometers. Those missiles have got angles of launch and angles of reentry that are much, much shallower. It's a situation like that. It's not a situation like that. And there are two systems today in the world, one of which the Kuwaitis are deploying, which is the Patriot system that developed out of an anti-aircraft missile. It was built in the late 1980s in the United States, which proved to be singular and ineffective in stopping Iraqi Scuds in the first Gulf War, but is a far, far, far different and much more capable weapon system today. And Israel is also working on a system which is called the Arrow system, which have successfully, time after time, intercepted shorter-range missiles, but they cannot intercept missiles that have such a steep angle of attack as these much longer-range 3,000, 4,000, 5,000-kilometer missiles. So that's the way the system is designed to work. Is this going to change? Okay. And what has our position been on national missile defense from the very beginning? It has been, until last spring, a position of ambiguity leading towards the probability that we would, in fact, agree to participate in missile defense. The decision that was announced by the Prime Minister last March, with great fanfare to the House of Commons of Canada, had other priorities and would not participate in missile defense, was a decision that took just about everyone by surprise, including, I may say, three former ministers of national defense, including the current leader of the Liberal Party, who urged the Prime Minister to, both Paul Martin and Jean Chrétien, to participate in missile defense. Took the Americans by surprise, took just about everyone by surprise, because it was expected that the announcement would be made to go ahead. And why? Because Canada was being asked fundamentally to give its political blessing to the missile defense system. It was not being asked at that particular time to actually participate in the system. But Canada had been, in a sense, discussing this question and over-discussing it and continuing to discuss it in much the same way, I must say, as Mr. Chrétien discussed whether or not we were going to purchase use British submarines for 4 years while they continued to rot in the seawater. And in that same way, this missile defense issue was discussed and not discussed until finally the announcement was made that we would not participate in missile defense. A part of this may have well been public opinion driven. I'm not going to make any partisan statements here about who does and who does not follow public opinion, but all public opinion is important to all political leaders. And November 2004, 52% opposed, 55%, you can see, not an important national objective. Let me just say that my own view is that the government did virtually nothing to try to sell Canadians on the merits of participation in missile defense, to explain why it was something that they thought was important. And so finally, I said it was March, it was in fact February, in the wake of a very strong opposition in Quebec, I think, and the precarious position of the Quebec Liberal Party and a number of other factors probably involving members of his own party caucus, the Prime Minister announced that Canada would not participate in missile defense and that we had other defense priorities. And it was a cheap decision. It cost us nothing at the time. But I think it was a decision that we will have to rethink in the long run. Is this working? Only part of the time. Okay. You got that?
Like one of the missile systems.
Yeah, like the missile system. Yeah. Okay. And U.S. reaction, of course, well, it was a mooted reaction, let's just say. It was the ambassador at the time, Mr. Salucci, did say a few things about his surprise and so on, but one of the things that Canada did subsequent to the missile defense decision was to agree that information acquired by the NORAD satellites and radar systems regarding missiles could be shared with U.S. Missile Defense Command. So even though Canada is technically not part of the missile defense system, we have agreed that NORAD will aid U.S. Missile Defense Command in the acquisition of data. Okay. You want to give me the next one? Okay. Should the debate be reopened? I think it should. Can you give me the next one, please? I think debate should be reopened because I think missile defense is inevitable. The first airplane flew in 1903. The first weapon was taken into the skies in 1905. Weaponization of space, I think, is as inevitable as the continuation of warfare as a state that humankind tolerates or causes for whatever reasons. Missile defense today, in terms of its long-range capabilities, is not very effective. What it will be 10 or 20 years from now is another story. Physicist friends of mine say it is a very, very difficult thing to do. I have not yet heard someone say it is physically impossible to do in the way that Einstein says it is physically impossible to fly faster than light. And if that's the case, you can be sure that those sides, those countries that believe that they have a stake in developing long-range missile technology will continue to do it, and those countries which feel that they are threatened by the development of these technologies by countries such as Iran will continue to try to develop systems to counter it. It's inevitable. It's not the question of it does it work today, it's a question of will it work 10 years from now or 15 years from now, and if it does, over how many acres of broken glass will Canada have to crawl to get back into the system once we know that it does work and the Americans are determined to go ahead with it, Democratic or Republican, because they believe that they must equip themselves with the defense against this sort of threat. That's doing this silly thing again. The main argument that's being used by the detractors is that it will lead to the militarization of space. It does have significant technical problems, as Mr. Layton says. Absolutely true. I don't think the question is, does it or doesn't it? But will it X number of years from now? Does not address the threat of WMD by other means? Absolutely true, and also expensive. But let me address all of these issues. The militarization of space is going to happen. Just like nuclear proliferation is happening. We worked hard, one of the cornerstones of Canadian diplomacy, during and after the Cold War, was to stop proliferation. And we sold a nuclear reactor to India, and they developed nuclear weapons. Pakistan developed nuclear weapons because India had nuclear weapons, and so on and so on and so forth. Proliferation is happening. Nuclear proliferation is happening. Weapons in space will happen. Just a matter of when. Significant technical problems, I think I've addressed that question. Does not address the threat of WMD. No, it will not stop somebody from putting a nuclear warhead in a freighter and bringing it into New York Harbor. But does that mean that we therefore don't try to stop to defend ourselves from it? It's like we try to fight all kinds of crime, but we know that some kinds of crime, people are going to get away with speeding and not stopping at stop signs and so on. Does it mean because we can't stop everything that we try to stop nothing? Of course not. It's an illogical argument. Expensive? We don't know what it will cost because we have not been asked to technologically participate in it. That's not what the Americans were asking us. Will it eventually cost us something if we join? It might well. I can't say that it will, or I can't say that it won't. But as I said, I think our participation is inevitable. I think it's in our national interest to do it. It has implications for our sovereignty. We renewed the NORAD agreement several weeks ago, but in the future, if missile defense becomes something that is an active, ongoing concern, the Americans continue to develop it, continue to pour resources into it. The question will be, will missile defense be part of NORAD or will it not be? If it's not part of NORAD, I believe that NORAD will sink into irrelevancy because the Americans will focus on the missile defense part of their air defense, and what we will be left with is a system that is going to be increasingly either obsolete or irrelevant, or we'll have to develop our own, which would cost us literally tens of billions of dollars. Security implications. I don't have to remind you of the close Canada-U.S. border connection and the number of communities that exist just one side of the border from the other. Can we sit back and allow missiles to be fired at Detroit and hope they won't land in Windsor? Or Seattle and Vancouver? The future of NORAD and future of Canada-U.S. defense relations. I want to say this. Prime Minister Mulroney decided not to participate in Star Wars. I think it was a good decision at the time. But the Prime Minister left open the door to future participation and also made clear at the time that all kinds of other cooperation with the United States would continue in the realm of continental defense. I think that it's very, very important that the Americans know, not that we'll do whatever they ask when it comes to continental defense, but that we will weigh any request that they make on the basis of our own national interests. And I don't think we did that last year with the missile defense decision that was made. So, them's my thoughts, and I'll change them if you gang up on me. Thanks.